Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is...
Neat!
It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
Well, hey, Liz, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
You know, doing all right.
Yeah.
All things considered.
All things considered. Well, that has to be understood now. Yeah. That you have to consider things when you ask people how they're doing.
Or there's a baseline of, that we're all dealing with.
Yeah, but, you know. Yeah.
Oof. Yeah. How have your days been?
My days.
How have your days been?
My days have been...
Or your nights, or both.
Yeah, they've been good. Fine. They've been fine. The fireworks aren't so much anymore. The last time we recorded, I couldn't get the fireworks off of our recording.
Yeah, that was every night for like the entirety of June. I heard some earlier when we were just chatting before this episode, but it has been a lot less.
Well, it's nighttime, so we might hear some.
Yeah.
But I got my cat a thunder shirt.
You've described what this is to me, but I think I liked what my head thought it was before you said it.
Thought
anything.
It was a shirt with like a thunderbolt on it.
Yeah, just like your cat just looks like a little baby Thor or something.
That would be cute.
Yeah.
It's more like a gray vest that looks like, you know, I look like I've put my cat to work in some kind of sanitation engineer or, you know, but what it is it's like a Velcro vest that has like, it like has like one flap and then another flap and then a third flap that just wraps you up real cozy.
Wow.
And it's supposed to feel like a hug. It's supposed to feel like you're being held. And so it's like, it's for dogs and cats that have anxiety because the pressure is supposed to feel nice.
Do they make those in human sizes?
I think they do because I've also read that it's really nice for people who have autism.
Oh.
Because sometimes the pressure feels comforting and can help you with anxiety. And I get that because I've experienced a weighted blanket. I don't own one yet. Not yet. But maybe one day.
I think I would be down for that. I like both the design, like being like gray and strappy sounds very like post-apocalyptic punk, which is a style I flirt with. But then also that it feels like a hug is another style that I would flirt with.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't describe the way that it looks as punk, but like you could punk it up. You could put some patches on it.
Yeah, patches. Like, wow, that's a really cool vest. Thank you. It feels like a warm hug when I'm scared. I'm down for that.
Yeah,
I'm
down for it. Yeah, I might get one. Hmm. You know, I might get one.
I think we all could maybe benefit from that.
We could all have a hug vest.
Just a little hug.
Yeah. Ugh. So how's your days, as you phrased it?
The days, they bleed into the nights, and it's just the day. It's just like one continuous...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I obviously, things are not reopening quite as fast as... Nor should they in New York, as originally was laid out.
Shut that shit down again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, like, I am not back to work at my bar yet. I don't think anyone's really comfortable being in service right now, nor should they be. I keep seeing all those videos of just like people brunching in like Midtown while like Black Lives Matter protests go by, and it's just it's everybody needs to eat lunch, that's fine, but maybe
read the room.
Yeah. Like think about the world around you before you decide where your priorities are.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to be one of those people, and I don't want to contribute to those people, I guess, by going back to work.
And there are lots of ways that you can support the restaurants that are open that need your support. You can order takeout. Sure can. You don't have to sit there and make somebody's life more dangerous. Have you seen the ones? Oh, I was going to send you those. There's some of these videos that like show some really fancy restaurants in Midtown that like with like a bunch of of servers bringing out Purell on a little like bread plate to each table.
That just seems so bleak.
It feels to me. Very topsy-turvy. It's a crazy world, man.
I'm not against, like, I want, look, obviously I have a vested interest in restaurants surviving, but the model that I've been practicing is I, you know, whether in person or over the phone, order from my favorite restaurants and just make sure to tip enough that it's like I would if I was sitting there for service.
Yeah.
So I don't like the excuse, like, well, I just want to support the restaurants. It's like, great, just over tip on your pickup, over yeah, tip on your delivery.
Absolutely.
I mean, I know every place, people listen all around the world to this show, every place is different, but mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of restaurants, bars, we do a booze cast.
We took a week off, first of all. So hello again.
That eight hour live stream. It wasn't 8 hours.
It was like five and a half hours. But it was great, and we did raise a lot of money for to donate to the Ochre Project. I will post those receipts for y'all. So combined with the money that we dedicated from our Patreon, which was the month of June, and the money that we raised during the live stream, we donated a total of $1,850.
Nice.
Which is awesome, because that's going to be worth a lot of meals. So, because each one costs $90. So that's going to be cool.
Yeah.
And you can continue to support the Ochre Project. You don't need us to take your money and give it to them. You can give it to them yourself.
Yeah. And that was very, very productive, very fun, magical live stream.
Oh my God, that was so much fun.
I think we were both just kind of dead for a couple days after that. I know I was.
Yeah. I thought that I had shingles because my mom told me that I had shingles. So
moms do that sometimes.
Sometimes, you know, when your mom tells you you have shingles, I don't have shingles. It's okay. But I do have a mysterious rash that the doctors don't know what it is, but it's actually gone away for the most part. That's I'm good. Showing Taylor right now.
Oh, all right. Yeah,
it's okay cool. now. It yeah, it's fine. It's okay. They kept trying to get me to admit that I had gone in the woods and gotten poison ivy, but that's not what happened. I haven't been near the woods.
They
so
were just that positive that it was poison ivy.
They were sure it was poison ivy, which doesn't make sense because poison ivy is like, if you have it and you touch it, then you get it where you touch it too. So I should like, and I was like, you know, rolling around in my bed and shit, like, just sleeping. That's how I sleep. But so I should have just like had it all over myself, but it was just on my arm. It was just like on a nerve. It's a mysterious thing. I don't know, but they couldn't figure it out at CityMD. They didn't know what to do, so they gave me steroids, and well, now I feel better.
Glad you're feeling better.
I don't think I have shingles. So that's good news. But that's what happened the week that we decided, you know what, we're going to take a week. At least that's what happened on my end. I felt kind of crazy for a few different reasons, but like that was part of it. I thought
okay.
I had shingles.
I am glad that you were here. I'm glad we are back together. And we've got a really, really cool episode coming up. So we're going to talk about two barrier breakers in the bar industry. There's some alliteration for you.
Ooh, barrier breakers in the bar industry. Yeah. I love that.
It's people that made a name for themselves in a time when it was really hard to.
Yeah. Yeah. And somehow it continues to be.
Still is hard to.
Still is hard. The same barriers that were broken, you just got to keep breaking them.
They managed to reform. I guess they aren't really broken. They just maybe jumped over them. But maybe. Then we all have to learn how to hurdle in our time.
Well.
Yeah. I don't. All right. So we're going to get into it. I want to talk about Ada Coleman.
Ada Coleman, eh?
Ada Coleman. Ada Coleman is now considered to be, like, she's made some lists of, like, one of the top 10 most important bartenders in the history of bartending.
Ooh.
Like, she's a seminal figure in the bar world. She's not, like, when people list off they're the most important bartenders, I feel like she's not included enough. I mean, like, I hadn't heard about her. Yeah. And it's a shame because well, I'll get into it, but like when you look at her contemporaries, it's like everybody else is a name that I know. It's mm-hmm. weird that I don't know her, except for maybe it's not weird because she was a woman among men that all made an all like went down as like seminal figures, and yet strangely enough she's not talked about enough. So I want to talk about her.
Okay, I'm excited to learn about her.
So Ada Coleman was born in London in 1875. Her father was a steward at a golf club owned by Rupert Doyley Cart. Steward is like a manager at this point.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I was laughing at Doyley.
It's like Doyley, but it's Doyley. Stewards had different meanings throughout time. At first I was like, that means he's a lord, right? Like, no, it just meant he was like a manager.
Okay.
Cart was like a very successful man to work for. He had hotels, he had theaters, he took a shine to the Coleman family. Mm-hmm. When Ada's father passed away, he made sure to help Ada find work.
Oh.
Her father died when she was 24, and Rupert employed her at his Claridge Hotel. He started her off in the flower shop, but she very quickly opted to transfer to the bar.
Okay. She knows where she wants to be.
Yes. Now, at the time, like, to be a 24-year-old entering the bar scene, that sounds like that's even on the young side, honestly, for, like, getting a bartending position, I think.
Okay.
You know? But at the time, that was not considered young. Like, women behind the bar were expected to be, like, under 25 or just don't apply.
They're like bar maidens.
Yes, they were called bar maids at the time. Mm-hmm. And they were vastly outnumbered to men in the industry. Like, one statistic I saw was like 375 men to every woman in the bar industry. So it wasn't that common for women to be behind the stick, and when they were expected to be young, and Ada was at the time not considered that. I mean, also, even, like, society as a whole didn't really love the idea of women behind the bar.
Big surprise.
Yeah. It was kind of, like a job that was, like, kind of okay if your family was, like, quote-unquote lower class. Like, there was, like, an article I read that was, like, it was acceptable for women who came from nice families, whose families fell on hard times and they had to make a way for themselves. Because I guess it's, like, well, they know how to entertain.
Oh, so that's, cool.
Yeah. Not like, and you know, like they didn't really think women had, like, it was bad for like the moral landscape of society, and also just women weren't physically tough enough to be bartenders.
Oh no, they can't lift glasses.
No. Just to their delicate tulip lips, they cannot lift them above their heads and shake them. Yeah, but nonetheless, she transferred to the bar. She made a name for herself at the Claridge Bar. There was actually the Claridge sommelier taught her how to make her first cocktail. Oh. It was a Manhattan.
So ah.
I like the idea of like some old wine dude like being like, don't worry, kiddo, I'm going to teach you the ropes. And he did. And she rose to success, to some level of fame. People really loved her. She was known for how quick her uptake was on the job, how fast she was, and also just that she had a wonderful personality. She was warm and friendly and fast and just a real rock star in her day.
Nice.
Yeah. Now at the same time as she was kind of having her rise in popularity, the Doyley Cart family opened the Savoy Hotel, which of course hosted the renowned, famous, sometimes infamous American bar that opened in 1893. It was opened under Frank Wells, who's another kind of iconic bartender from bar history. He okay. was the first head bartender there, and when he retired, she took over the place. She took over the job from him in 1903. So she transferred there and then worked her way very quickly up to head bartender.
Oh, wow.
Now, it's been stated that she was the first and only female bartender at the American Bar. That's not true. She was the first female head bartender, but actually, there was another woman by the name of Ruth Burgess who started there in 1902. So started there a year before Coleman. And apparently they didn't get along too well. Which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
It's a tale as old as time that women are pitted against each other. I think anybody that's of any sort of different identity is typically given a marginalized place to exist in industries, especially mm-hmm. the restaurant industry. And yeah, so they didn't work the same shifts, largely because Coleman didn't want to share her recipes with Burgess. And then even after Coleman left the industry, she, in her interviews, she really just wouldn't mention Ruth. Kind of erased her from the story.
You know what? I was thinking about this when we first talked about talking about Ada Coleman. I came across that little tidbit and I was like, oh man, that sucks. Like why would, like, you know, you're the only two women, like, why would you be against each other? But not only, like, obviously they're pitted against each other and just like kind of really made to feel like they aren't supposed to be here in the first place, so the fact that there's two of them. But I did read that they didn't want to be on, or she didn't, Ada didn't want to be on the same shifts. But then at the same time, if, like, you're 300 men to one woman and you get put on the same shift as the other, one other woman, that's like, are you trying to make a thing out of this?
It's
like,
the girl shift.
It's the girl shift. It's the lady hour. Like, you know, that would suck too.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and it's not, it's unfortunate, but it's true. And I don't judge people that do what they have to do to survive to a certain extent. And I know, like, that's one of the things I've witnessed so many times in the industry, where the number way you kind of endear yourself to the men you work for is by belittling other women. I've seen that. I've had it done to me. I've seen it done. Like, it's just, it's not something that we're, it's out of our system yet. It's like part of joining the boys club, if you're allowed in as the you know, as the random woman or non-male identifying person, mm-hmm. is making it clear that you play by the same rules as the boys club. And that's still not true.
Gross.
Yeah. So anyway, but, you know, Coleman, as the head bartender at the American Bar, she really was sort of a darling in the industry. She served Charlie Chaplin. She served Marlene Dietrich, the Prince of Wales, Mark Twain. I was specifically excited about Marlene Dietrich because
that's what I'm the most excited about.
I know, they're all cool figures. I was like, oh, iconic. Like, I would like to have been at that service. But yeah, and I mean, a lot of people credit her for really the launch of the American Bar for international renown. Like, that she's the one that put it on the map. She's the one that made it a destination spot for people to go to. And I mean, there are all these, like, loving quotes from famous people just about how warm she was, how personable she was, how talented she was. She really, really endeared herself to the people she worked for and the people that she served. She was a big fan of theater, and the Doyle Cart family owned some theater companies.
Nah.
So she would throw these, like, lavish late night parties, like after hours parties with, you know, theater performers and music and singing and dancing, and just really, like, that was kind of like the cool place to be.
Oh, nice.
Was at one of Coley's parties.
Ooh. So she does know how to entertain.
She definitely knew how to entertain. And she also knew how to make a drink. She is credited with the creation of one of what's considered one of the, like, the 50 most important cocktails in, like, the craft of cocktailing. It's one of the cocktails will come up on any short list of things you should know how to make. And that drink is the Hanky Panky.
Oh, the Hanky Panky, you say.
Hanky Panky. So the story goes, there was this, at the time, celebrated comedic actor by the name of Sir Charles Hawtrey. Yes.
Hawtrey.
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 He came into the bar and he was rather tired, and he asked for something to be given, something that, quote, had a bit of a punch in it.
Oh, he wants a punch.
Yeah, and according to her words, she spent hours trying to figure out what that would be.
What, like, does that mean?
I know. Like it was the next time he came in that then she was like, here's the drink that you were asking for the other day.
Oh my god.
But I kind of, like, I can respect that, because there's definitely, like, making bespoke cocktails, like cocktails a la minute, like, to order is really cool. But there are definitely those times where people have asked me for things and I'm like, I can do that. And then, like, later that night I'll be like, but the actual better thing I could have given you would have been if I did this. So seems a little silly that she spent hours. Like, I'm sure she gave him a drink. She wasn't like, I'll get back to you on that. No drinks for you now.
Yeah.
But she created this a drink that was not a completely uncommon formula. It was equal parts gin and sweet vermouth with a couple dashes of Fernet Branca. And it was shaken, which nowadays, you know, we don't shake drinks that have those ingredients usually, but she shook it.
She did it, you know? She was breaking barriers.
Yeah, shaking and breaking barriers. garnished with an orange twist. And when she gave it to Hawtrey, he tried it and he exclaimed, by Jove, that is the real hanky-panky.
Oh, that's the quote?
Yep.
What? That's a real quote.
That's what she recounted.
By Jove.
It does not get more British than that.
That's the hanky-panky. I don't even think... Yeah, that's the most British sentence I've ever heard, I think.
Yeah, I think that's it. I thought because I think our modern association with the term hanky panky is like sexy stuff.
Sexy, yeah.
At the time, it was the hanky panky.
That one.
Well, at the time, it was more associated with like witchcraft or magic.
Oh.
So he was more just saying like, that's magical.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good God, you're a magician.
Basically, yeah. Which I guess is a little bit less of a weird thing to say than, wow, that drink is sexual. That drink is like foreplay.
That's the sexy magic.
I think, well, that's where we can land on it now in modern times. We have both definitions. It's sexy magic.
I think, yeah, it's a good compromise.
I like that.
I just like the word hanky-panky,
I don't know if it makes, it like borders on, it might be gross, but it's also funny. So that's where it falls for me. And I mean, it's a real drink. You can order it in a bar. It's still very popular. It's still served to this day around the world.
Would you order it?
Would I order it? To me, it plays a little sweet for my palate. My palate is like bitter.
Okay.
Yeah.
But would you say the words hanky panky?
There's also that. There's also having to ask somebody for a hanky panky. And I also feel like in the pantheon of classic drinks, it falls ever so slightly outside of like what people assume you will know how to make or what people think they have to know how to make. Mm-hmm. That it's kind of, you might say this very silly word and people won't know what you're talking about. You just sound like, oh.
And then you have to repeat it.
Yeah, it's not like saying
I have a hanky-panky?
It's not like saying like, oh, like I want a Boulevardier. It's like if someone's like, I don't know how to make that, it's like, oh, but I still said a cool word, Boulevardier. But like hanky-panky, it's like,
give me a hanky-panky.
That is inappropriate.
Excuse me, sir,
I do not know your name. Yeah. So in any case,
well,
the
hanky
panky was born. So the Savoy shut down for renovations in 1925. Nicole was about 51 at the time. And so the story goes, she retired and was replaced by the American barman Harry Craddock, who had been working under her as a service bartender for a couple years.
Oh.
He was sort of an American expat, came over during Prohibition. He was an American bartender, fled because obviously no bars in America. He's the author of the Savoy Cocktail Book.
Oh, yeah, he wrote the book.
Yeah, which features the hanky-panky and does credit Coleman for that one drink. Now, the sort of conflicting story here is that did Coley really retire or was she sort of forced out of her job? And the thoughts here are that, like, for one thing, this other female bartender, Ruth Burgess, who still worked there, she also did not return to work when they reopened after the renovation. So the two female staff members were both suddenly gone. Coley was then working at a flower shop after that. So it's not like she retired. She was still having to work for a living. She just wasn't in her position at the bar. And then there's also some reports that specifically that Harry Craddock didn't love working under a woman. So,
okay.
And I mean, to add on top of that, like the American idea of women behind the bar wasn't really in favor. So all of these American expats that were fleeing America due to Prohibition to drink in other bars weren't very welcoming to women behind the bar, and that was a big influx of drinkers.
Damn, America, yeah, fucking it up for everybody.
So it's highly possible that Coley was kind of forced into an early retirement because of good old fashioned sexism.
Good old fashioned sexism.
Now, is that believable? I mean, I will say that I've been a manager of a bar program for just about 2 years, and this is in the modern age. This is
the modern era.
Now, yes. In like New York City, which is supposed to be progressive, dissolved, heck. To be. And I've had to push back against so many men for my job. Like, I've had new hires, like male bartenders, that as soon as they realize they're working under a non-male person, like, gunning for my job from day one. I mean,
just immediately discredited.
Oh, yeah. Like,
not believed that you could be good at your job.
When I actually got the bar manager job, there were only men that had the job before me. And when the man that worked before me left for a better job, the only senior staff members, full-time staff members that were there were me and another woman. That's how I identified at the time. And so instead of picking one of us, they just gave the job to both of us at half the pay.
What?
Yeah. So it took two non-men to do a man's job.
But you're both doing just as much work.
Same amount of work. Oh, yeah. We're still on call. Like, half
of the pay. And, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That seems fair.
Yeah. Yeah. And like eventually my co-bar manager, not a thing, quit out of frustration. And even then I was like, well, at least I'll go back to the normal manager's pay. And that was an argument that I lost. So what the fuck? I made less. And
it's pretty believable that
very believable
in 1925 Ada encountered sexism.
I mean, it's
possibly,
I think it's still,
you think maybe,
I think it's very believable that could have been a thing that happened. Honestly, like, when I look at, like, man, she held on that position for like a couple decades. How much shit did she have to eat to hold that position? That's all I can think about. Yeah. It's just been like my 2 years, and I'm like, I don't want to have to keep advocating for the position that I'm already underpaid to do. I just, more than anything, I like wish she could give me, like, her ghost could appear before me and she could tell me how to be better at like dealing with it.
I mean, she eventually was like, I mean, it kind of sounds like, I don't know if she was forced out or if she just got to a breaking point where she was like, fuck this shit. Because it kind of sounds like, fuck this shit, I'm going to go work in the flower shop.
Like, I mean, that's, yeah. Like,
I'm 50. Look, like,
She held it down for, you know, 20 some years. But
I don't know, man.
Can't say I don't understand. Not conspiracy theories. I think they're very real, like, opinion, like, very real,
informed opinions. Yes. Yeah.
That as to why she was forced into retirement. And like I said, she kept working. She was interviewed after her quote unquote retirement while she was employed by other hotels. She was like managing staff at the Berkeley Hotel for a while, like over like the women's like sitting room, like, and okay, like coat room, like, so it doesn't sound like she didn't like move up the ladder. She just moved into a position that was more okay for her as in like an older woman. But she was interviewed by the London Daily Express. They called her the queen of cocktail mixers, England's most famous barmaid, and you know, nice. She said that she probably poured a million drinks in her career. Clearly loved what she did. And I mean, you know, now she was remembered as one of the great female bartenders. Now she remained the only female head bartender at the American Bar until 2017 when Philippa Pippa guy took over the position, which sounds like, oh, cool. So there was another female bartender that got the role. In 2017.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. I don't know if I like, that
that's
sounds
almost
like
almost 100 years.
Right? We've got two.
Like, because she, okay, so she left in 1925, right?
Yeah.
And then 2000, that's literally a little bit less than 100 years later is when they get the next female head bartender.
Like, it was, like, kind of, like, the way progress, that the... Progress, guys. Yeah, that, like, the articles that I read were like, oh, isn't this awesome? I'm like, well, it's not actually that awesome that it took that long and that there's, like, one.
That's kind of embarrassing.
And also, I'm like, what's going to happen to Pippa? Like, when is she going to be forced into retirement?
Does Pippa have to deal with this shit?
I want to check in on Pippa. I want to go when Americans are allowed to leave America again, which who knows when.
No.
I'm going to go to the American bar and just check in on Pippa and just, like, ask her if she's okay.
Pippa, are you listening?
Are people respecting you?
Tell us if you're okay.
Are you being treated well?
Write in. Call in.
This hasn't really changed that much. There are lots of female bartenders now. I know that the numbers are not 375-1 anymore.
No, the numbers are better.
But
the treatment is not great.
The treatment's not great. And there's still kind of an understanding that, like, a lot of the high-end bars, I mean, there's just understood, like, bars in the industry, like, that are high-end places that you just know if you apply as a non-male, you're not going to get a job. Like, they'll occasionally hire somebody as sort of a token to hold up and be like, here's the one woman on our staff of, like, we have 10 bars around the world, like, international establishments, and here we have one woman in one of those bars. Like,
yeah.
It's not unheard of.
It's not good enough, guys.
Yeah. So Coley, after retiring, after working for a while at the Berkeley Hotel, she passed away in 1966 at the impressive age, I mean, consider the time period she lived through, of 91.
Wow.
Now, of course, still, like, her legacy, like, the hanky-panky is still served around the world. It is still found at the Savoy. They make two versions of it, actually. One that's her classic version and one that they do, like, a barrel aging on, which sounds pretty cool.
Oh, cool.
There's actually I haven't been there, but there is a speakeasy called Ada's Place in the Hudson Yards that is apparently very beautiful. The head bartender there is Jeff Bell, who rose to fame at Please Don't Tell, PDT, another, like, iconic New York speakeasy style bar.
Cool.
Sounds really great. The menu looks great.
I don't assume that they're open right now.
They're not open right now. No. They're built on top of another restaurant. I can't think of how it is. But yeah, you know, it's funny that it's named after Ada Coleman, but it's bar program led by a man. But all right.
take them as they come.
I want her to have honor, however. Yeah, it's cool that it's honoring her because she's definitely an underappreciated, like, all of these other people, like, literally the head bartender that came before her at the Savoy and the head bartender that came after her at the Savoy are in the bar industry kind of household names.
Mm.
She's strangely left out of that kind of progression.
Yeah, that is strange. It's so strange. It's almost on purpose. I don't know.
There's that.
It seems intentional. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's all Coley. So definitely over in the video we'll talk about how to make you a hanky panky we can celebrate her.
Give
her the credit she's
right deserved. And now y'all know who she is, so, you know, if you are into Harry Craddock's shit, get into Ada Coleman shit because she trained him.
Yeah,
how many of those recipes are not actually Craddock's?
I mean, I'm not gonna give ground to uncredited sources, but there is that kind of supposition that, like, he forced her out, he begrudgingly credited her for the hanky panky, but, like, she was known for her cocktails. There were a lot of recipes she had that she did not share with people. That anyway, but that's hearsay.
That is hearsay. We can't. That means that we can't prove it.
And I don't know.
But we can say it.
And I don't also know that Craddock was a bad dude. He did take her job at an age where she was still looking for jobs, but we don't know the details.
We don't know the details.
Could have been management.
It's usually management. But hey.
All right. What you got for us, Liz?
Well, I have another story of a barrier-breaking badass named Jewel Thais Williams, who was the owner of the Jewel's Catch One, which is one of the first black discos in America.
Nice.
And really the first black owned disco. She owned it for 41 years. There's a lot of reasons that make her a barrier breaking person. Number one, she was a black woman who, you know, like built herself up from basically nothing. She was born May 9th in 1939. She was the fifth of eight kids, and their family was originally from Arkansas. She was born in Gary, Indiana. They moved around a bit. They went to San Diego after her uncles and cousins who were there serving in the Navy for the World War II naval draft. They got drafted, and so they were in San Diego, and they were like, hey, come on over to San Diego. It's sunny all the time, you know, like, come over here where there's some family. So the family moved over there. They shared a one-bedroom house. So very, very humble beginnings for her. And she started working at age 9 at her uncle's corner grocery store, and that's where she got some independence, and she kind of got bitten by the entrepreneurial bug.
So it happens.
Yeah.
You get some money in your pocket.
Yeah, she's like, hey, I got an idea. She moved to LA after high school. She worked an incredible variety of jobs. She worked in maid service. She worked as a customer care representative. She was a recreational director, a probation attendant, a deputy sheriff at one point. And she started going to school part-time at UCLA. She decided that she wanted to complete school, which meant that she really needed to like work on her own schedule because she went to school during the day. So she had to find a way to make a living that worked around that. And she reasoned that the only way that she could do that is if she was self-employed. This was like, from a pretty early age, she decided that the way that she was going to make it in the world would have to be through self-employment. And that was also due to the kind of job discrimination she faced as a black woman, and also like seeing that happening to her family members and people in her community. It made it really clear in her mind that working within the system wasn't really going to let her get where she wanted to be. Mm. So she had another layer that society put on her of otherness, that she was also a lesbian.
Yeah.
She recalled later in life that, like, you know, she had intimate encounters with other women, but she didn't actually realize that she was a lesbian until she was in her mid-20s. And that was when she went on her first, like, date with a woman with a coworker that she worked at the Safeway with. And they ended up dating for like 11 years. They had a really long relationship. So back to her entrepreneurial, that's her personal life. That'll come back. She decided that she was going to open a boutique. That's what she wanted to do. That was like her first like business, right? So she started her clothing boutique and it went well. And then the early 70s, there was like a recession. And so her business started to go down. And she decided that she was going to look into more recession-proof businesses.
Ah, what's more recession-proof than
alcohol?
Yeah.
Well, her brother actually suggested that she should buy a liquor store, but she wanted something more personal.
Okay.
Yeah. She saw an advertisement that there was a bar for sale, and she knew the bar because it was across the street from where the Safeway that she worked at was. There was like a little corner bar. She knew that place was like very much an establishment that catered to white patrons. And she even, and this was called the Diana Club at the time. She had actually heard from customers that came into the Safeway that they were like complaining because they didn't want black people coming into their neighborhood bar. And so to this, she thought, one of these days, I'll own that club and everybody and anybody will be able to come.
Aww.
Yeah, isn't that fucking cool?
That's awful that she had to nod to a customer who would say something super racist.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, and it was like, that was 1973.
Yeah.
We kind of think of like the 70s as progressive times, but, and this is in LA.
No.
Not so much. It wasn't progressive, by the way. Well, the 70s where was...
What I mean, very, what about the racist, 2020s? Like, what about now? Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, it's all bad, guys.
We renamed some streets and, you know,
yeah,
got rid of the racist pancake batter.
No.
Syrup, rice, I don't know. Good. Yeah, okay. Not real progress. Go ahead.
Okay. So she did make progress in her time. She bought that club in 1973 with a down payment of $1,000 and an agreement to pay the rest, which was a total of $18,000, within 2 months. She tells this story in a lot of interviews that she did, that like there was a sign that said like that it was good for 30 days. She came in when she knew that the bartender was drunk or the bar manager was drunk. And she was like, oh, I just have to fix the sign because the tape's peeling off. And she had another sign that gave her another 30 days so that she could stall and get the money together.
I love that.
So instead of she had 30 days and then she had 60 days. So she did get it together. She borrowed money. She hawked her valuables.
I want a movie already.
She should have a movie. She really should have a movie about her life. It just like it keeps going. It's like, I mean, she hasn't even got the club yet and it's fucking epic. Her partner at the time, Marion, who was the woman that she met at Safeway, they like had some properties that they sold. Her brother-in-law helped her get an advance to cover the rest of the costs and she secured it. So she acquired the club and the white patrons started disappearing and the white bartender walked out on her because a lot of like the white employees that were there didn't want to work for a black woman.
Wow, that's so crazy and unbelievable in my modern mind.
Right.
Yeah. Never seen that happen.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Still happens all the time. But the reason was because they thought that the place was going to close. They thought that they weren't going to have a job. So they, also being just racist. And there was also a law in California that women could not tend bar unless they owned it. This was in 1973.
Well, I would love to know the basis for that law. Like, what's the reasoning behind it?
That's interesting because I tried to look up what was going on and it's hard to like research a lot about those kind of laws that aren't actually in effect anymore because these are state by state laws. But I did read that in 1960, there was, and it was actually like lobbied by like the bar employee union. They have some kind of weird acronym for them. This is all really interesting stuff. I'm sure we can go into other point too. But just like to give you a little background, the unions lobbied after World War II because there were women tending bar in America from like the 1920s to the 1940s, but then when the men came back they wanted their jobs back, right. And the union lobbied to make it illegal for women to tend bar on the basis that they were not emotionally or temperamentally capable of doing that.
I mean, kind of the same logic that took a lot of those jobs that women had comfortably been working.
Right, you know, because I might, like, get my period all over the bar or something.
Sometimes
I don't know.
That happens. Honestly, I can't tell you how many bar shifts where I've just perioded all over the place. Sometimes you just... Sometimes you just cry, you know?
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Like, all of my drinks are high on the saline factor.
This daiquiri is really salty. Yeah, I'm sorry. You know,
I cried in it.
I'm a woman.
It happens.
Oh, my God. So there was like by 1960, there were 26 states that had laws against women tending bar. So in 1973, California was still one of them. And basically, like, there were movements to like try to get these laws repealed. The Supreme Court eventually ruled like, oh, well, you're allowed to challenge these laws. Basically, somebody has to organize in each state to get these discrimination-based laws removed. It's real messy. But as of 1973 in California, women were not allowed to tend bar unless they owned it.
It's not surprising, I guess, but at the same time, it's like, that's not the past.
It's pretty recent.
That's our parents' generation.
Yep, yeah. And so when her bartender walked out on her, you know, technically she was allowed to tend bar because she owned the place, but she didn't know how. She didn't have any bar skills or bar management skills because how would she have had that experience before? But she knew what she wanted and she made it work. There was actually one of the customers that had been a regular at the Diana Club who stuck around. His name was Tex. Jewel recalls him really fondly. He helped her through the initial phases of setting up the business and was like, okay, you're going to be all right. I'll show you how to do all this stuff. She took to it. She was doing everything. She was like just fixing this place up from the ground up. When things started picking up, some of the white customers that had previously left returned and actually became really strong regulars and like built a really good relationship with her. And the bartender that had quit on her came back and apologized and asked for his job back. And she gave it to him.
Well,
that's very gracious of her.
That is very good. That's the word for it. That is gracious.
Yes, yes. But she literally did everything. Like, she tended bar, she worked security, sometimes she DJ'd, she would wake up every morning and buff the dance floors. So the discrimination that she faced as a black woman owning a club was really not unlike the discrimination that she faced as a black woman going to clubs in LA.
Huh.
Because the black community, and particularly the black gay community, was severely underserved and frequently just not welcome in many of the nighttime establishments of West Hollywood. You could be denied admission, like, just completely arbitrarily because you were black, or because you were brown, because you were a woman, because you were a lesbian, because you were gay. Jewel's Club became a place where everyone could come and be themselves, and that was really her mission. Like, she saw that there were people who didn't have a place to go, and she was part of that community, and she wanted to make a place for everybody to be able to come. So it was a safe haven for black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people to gather together. And she transformed a place that once shunned her and folks like her into a place where everyone was welcome.
So badass.
Yeah, it's fucking badass. And she had all kinds of clientele. She had like blue collar white clientele during the day, and at night the scene would just like transform into the hot spot that was really just for the underserved queer black community. And she saw those people mingling. She said, like, in a few interviews that she was kind of, first she was like nervous about the different crowds seeing each other, but then eventually just like everybody was hanging out together. And she talks about like a party where like a lesbian and an old white guy were sharing a birthday cake because it was both their birthdays. And like it really seemed very special. There's actually, and I will plug this because this is what inspired me about this story, there's a documentary on Netflix about Jewel and Jewel's Catch One. There's a lot of like really cool interviews in it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so check that out. But it wasn't all fun.
Oh, here's the reality.
Because here come the popos.
Oh.
Just messing up everybody's fun. And, you know, doing all their other things that cops do, like beating people. The Vice Squad showed up about a week or two after she opened. Basically, like, the alcohol and beverage control unit, whatever, could do unannounced checks of bars and establishments. But they usually only do them once a year, and they usually, for like most of the places in West Hollywood, they would do them during the day, like 2 p.m. or like 10 a.m. when like they're not going to find anything. Like, it's just like a formality, whatever. They were doing them every day to Jewel's place, and they would do them at like 1:30 a.m., like, you know, when like the party is happening.
Oh, so this is the same way they attack the queer community in New York.
Yes.
Like pre-Stonewall.
Exactly. Exactly. Cool. The same. And this was a really common harassment to gay and lesbian establishments. And at the time, there were ordinances in California law and really throughout the country, but, you know, we're talking about California here, that prohibited same-sex dancing or dressing in clothes other than that of their assigned sex,
right,
or anything else that was associated with the homosexual lifestyle.
I like the way you just said homosexual. It's very
homosexual lifestyle.
Mysterious.
Just like anything. They're like, that's too gay. So that was a bummer. They had to deal with that.
Right.
They just had to deal with that. And they were like, there were cop cars parked outside every day, but people kept coming. They dubbed it the Catch or Catch One because it was a place where patrons could catch one, catch a mate.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good hookup spot.
Yeah. Jewel talked about like having business cards printed up that were like, Jewel's Catch One or more. Like, you know,
I like that.
Yeah. But it also became a place where you could catch some pretty famous people hanging out, because Jewel didn't allow paparazzi in the club.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was also a safe escape for celebrities like Whitney Houston, Luther Vandross, Janet Jackson, Donna Summer, Madonna, Rick James.
Damn.
Yeah, just like everybody. It was like the unofficial Studio 54 of the West Coast.
The better.
Yeah.
Studio 55.
Yeah. So because of her role running in the club and the lifestyle that went with it, she had her ups and downs. She battled with substance abuse in the height of the club's popularity because, for one thing, it was really in her nature to not only provide this, like, safe playground for people in her community and ostracized members of the community, also job support. So she hired a lot of people. She hired a lot of folks in the Black gay community that needed a job, which is wonderful, but it also left her with, like, less to do as far as running the club. So she became bored a little bit, or the way that she describes it, it seems like she just lacked purpose. Even with her success, she experienced a lack of self-worth. She said she drank to cover her shyness, and, you know, and then also she dated a lady that was a cocaine user. Mm. And she describes this as her 7 years in the wilderness, where she was doing drugs and drinking a lot. And she eventually decided that she wanted more out of her life, and she had a calling to be of service to her community. So she actually became sober.
Oh, wow.
She joined AA, and she made a promise to herself that if running the Catch One was ever going to come between her and her sobriety, then the Catch would have to go. But she was able to run it and be sober and just keep doing her thing, because that's not even where it ends. So she has this building. She bought the building. She lives in the building. And then, you know, business is booming. Jewel resisted upgrading the club. Instead, she chose to put the funds into community projects.
Cool.
So in the early 80s, Jewel began to be personally affected by the AIDS epidemic. She experienced many of the performers and friends that she had known through the club getting sick with things like pneumonia and succumbing quickly, really quickly, to the illness. And so she really quickly became involved in confronting the crisis in her own community in LA through the Minority AIDS Project. And the club actually was really more important for the community during this time than ever. This was like a time when, like, people were afraid to hug.
Wow.
Because of the AIDS crisis, because they just didn't know about it. People were dying at a really, really fast rate. In some of the interviews that I saw, Jewel's partner, Rue, talks about at one point, like, there were funerals, like, sometimes twice a week. Jeez. They lost a lot of people. The community that frequented the club was just devastated, like, really just disappearing. Even the police stopped raiding because they were afraid to come in. Yeah. During this time, she opened the club to house young people and others who had nowhere else to go, because the AIDS crisis also outed a lot of people. Right. So, like, there was a lot of people who became houseless or housing insecure. At this time, the Catch One became a different type of haven for these young people and people who had nowhere else to go. This led her to co-founding with her partner, Rue, the first housing community for women living with AIDS and their children. So at this time, there wasn't a place for women to go that they could also bring their children. And that was, like, a really big deal that they, like, created this housing community. She regards her involvement in the response to the AIDS epidemic as probably the most important work that happened within our community at that time. And it was, like, we've talked about in the past of, like, queer nightlife being a safe haven. Like, this is an example of, like, like, she opened her place to these people.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine, like, the bulk of the AIDS epidemic, just the not knowing, the prejudice and understanding. I mean, just to fully embrace people that needed somebody to.
Yeah. Like, that's... She really took on a lot. And she was there for her community in a way that, like, the government wasn't there for it, like,
no, the government was actively against helping these
exactly.
people.
Exactly. Now, in 1985... there was a really suspicious fire. Somebody had tried to buy the building prior to the fire.
Okay.
And Jewel wouldn't sell. Miraculously, The fire stopped before burning down the entire bar, but the damage was still pretty bad. There's many suspicious things about this. The news reports like talk about a pipe bomb. Also, the fire station was less than 3 minutes away, but it took them more than 20 minutes to get there, which was like at the point that like it was up in flames.
Cool.
And the next day after the fire, Jewel had to call the fire department back because some of the embers had started to flame up again. And she overheard the firefighters outside because the roof was gone, so she could just hear them. They were saying that they'd wished it had burned down.
Cute.
Yeah. And then they never came back to investigate. They said that there wasn't anything to investigate. And then soon after that, she got a call from the real estate company that had sold the building to her that they had a buyer that would pay her whatever she wanted. And she told them, "You do not have enough money to buy this building from me."
All right. So she kept it.
She kept it. And nice. It took her 2 years to get the club open again, which, you know, like you can imagine. I mean, it shouldn't take 2 years. It was like every way that, you know, they could have fast tracked permits or whatever. Like she had to fight tooth and nail to get the permits and the resources she needed. But she did open it again in 1987. The crowds changed, and Jewel allowed promoters to come in and throw different party nights, including Das Bunker, which is like a goth industrial scene.
Cool.
Yeah. But I think like this is a little bit of editorializing on my part, but really you could say that gentrification had a lot to do with the crowds changing, where like once it had been like the place where the Black gay community could have a space that was for them, but like, you know, like Madonna was like really into it, and people started coming because Madonna was coming. So like her crowd brought in a bunch of like young white people, and the same patrons that were there before didn't really want to stay. And Jewel actually said in an interview about this, "It was not without some very painful experiences for me." I'm sure. Yeah, because she and Jewel herself got accused of being a racist because the clientele in her bar was changing, which she really didn't have any control over. So she turned her focus once again to serving her community. After an experience she had with a culturally incompetent doctor, she took up another mission to educate her community by teaching about and providing preventative care to African-American individuals and families who often don't receive the same medical treatment as their white counterparts.
Right.
Yep, this is the thing, guys. So while she still owned the club, she went back to school to get a master's of science in Oriental medicine, and she opened a nonprofit called the Village Health Foundation in 2001 with the purpose of serving lower-income communities. The clinic operated on a donation-based sliding scale and offered services including acupuncture, traditional Chinese medicine, yoga, meditation, massages, strength training, Zumba, jazz dance, Tai Chi, emotional counseling, abuse treatment, individual, family, and group counseling, as well as medication therapy and management. Like, she started a health center, and she bought the building next to her the Village Health Clinic.
Well, that's a different kind of community, like, gathering place. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have to include the alcohol and the drugs and the party scene.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice. And she used that space as a community hub, too, for, like, political organizers to hold meetings. It was like a community center, basically. She owned the building that housed Catch One, the building next to it, which was the Village Health Foundation, and a vegan restaurant across the street.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. She just really did it.
She created a great little corner there, sounds
she
like.
She did, yeah. And she owned that for 41 years. She owned the Catch One. The patronage kind of was falling off, and it was increasingly hard for her to sustain the club. So she was going to shut down the club in November 2015. But before she shut it down, it was bought by Steve Edelson and his son Mitch Edelson. And they renamed it the Union, so it is still a club now. But in 2018, with the blessing of the community and the blessing of Jewel, the name was changed back to Catch One.
Aww.
Yeah, in honor of its historical significance in the LGBTQ+ community and in honor of Jewel.
I love that.
Yeah.
So there's still a place you can go, and it's the same bar.
There's still, it's owned by different people. It is owned by different people, but It is still a historical landmark. It is still a disco. And Jewel is 81 now, and she's still running the Village Health Foundation, and she's still a very active leader in the community. Like, she is still doing it.
I want to meet this lady someday.
She's legendary. Like, she does need a movie.
Yeah, she deserves one. Thank you, Jewel. Wow.
Yeah, man. And, like, this is, like it was so monumental until I did this research and really dove into this. I think I took it for granted how monumental it was and still is for an establishment of this fame and caliber to be owned by not only a Black woman, but a lesbian Black woman in the 70s. Even today, it was world famous. It's fucking cool. It's amazing. In interviews, like, she's very, like, bright and joyous, but she's also very reserved. Like, she talks about herself as a shy person. You wouldn't really peg her as, like, someone who's like, I'm gonna own the world famous club. And, like, you know, because when I think of, especially from my experience in the restaurant industry and in the, like, the nightclub industry, it's all a boys club. It's all, yeah, like, mostly cis straight white men.
Yeah.
And just, like, dominated by that, like, toxic masculinity and, like, yeah, racism and misogyny rampant. I just can't believe, like, how revolutionary this place was, not even for the time, just, like, for all time.
But, you know, it really, you know, I think when we first talked about these, like, pairing these two stories, it kind of seemed like, oh, these were similar, like, you know, important revolutionary figures. But now that I'm thinking of it, like, it's a bit more of the difference between filling a place that's allowed to you by the people that are already in control versus making a place for yourself and ultimately playing by the rules and getting, like, offered, like, a, you know, a token position.
Yeah,
you still are at their whims, but this is somebody that made a place for herself, and so ultimately she made the rules, and that's a better position to be in. And right. I mean, it's a lot harder. It's a but million she also times had harder.
To. She didn't have a choice. She wasn't going to be able to be in that system.
Well, I guess that's also, you know, white women can find places for themselves. Those places aren't great, but they have a role in society.
Exactly.
People of color have always had to define places for themselves.
Exactly. Yes. Damn. I mean, Ada is like, that was a completely different time, too.
It was a different time, and I think she's a badass in her own right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think when you, I can say that I, you know, like, I've, and me and a lot of bartenders in similar positions, we play the game because we think that's the only option to us.
Yep.
But then you hear a story like that, like, Jewel was working in a time when, I mean, that's still, like, that's a much harder time than you know, people like me are dealing with, and she made a place for herself.
Yeah. And so, she fought, and she kept fighting. Well, that's the thing. Like, she had to fight, like, from day one until the day that she gave up her spot. And that was, like, you know, in 2015, it was, like, it was just hard to keep maintaining. And I think, like, she had other interests and saw other ways that she could serve the community. But, like,
sure, yeah.
She had to, like, after, I mean, 1985, when that fire happened, it was, like, everyone thought that was the end, and then she was, like, nope, I'm not done yet. Not until I'm done. Not until I say I'm done.
Right.
But even, like, just the life expectancy for a nightclub back then was, like, 2 years, and she was determined to beat that.
That's a really beautiful story.
Thanks. I mean, it's not my story, but
no. Thank you for sharing.
Yay!
What a couple of badass ladies.
Yeah, but, you know, trailblazers.
And I mean, they're inspirational stories. Obviously, as we reflected on, unfortunately, that it's still not the norm for people of color, for non cis males, to feel completely comfortable in the restaurant industry. There's still a lot of racism and sexism and misogyny, and it's not great. Like,
no,
you, in one way, you'd think it was very progressive because it's an industry that welcomes all people, and that's true, but the people that work their way to the top always end up kind of looking the same, or start at the top rather.
Yeah,
maybe that's it.
A lot of them start at the top.
Yeah, that's true.
Nepotism is really big. It'd be fun to talk about that sometime.
Yeah. Anyway. I kind of always, anytime we go in close to these territories, like, how much do I want to never be able to work in my industry again?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think like one thing that's kind of coming out, there's a lot of things coming out of people not having the jobs that they would usually have or not being able to be in the same spaces, is that you have like a little bit more time to think about and prioritize, especially when, you know, what we were talking about in the restaurant industry, where it's like, okay, people want to go out and whatever, and like we want to still make money, but like, is it worth your, for a most likely uninsured restaurant worker to put their health at risk if you get sick? Like,
I mean, that's true. And like, ultimately, like, working for people that don't care about your safety, you're maybe lining your pockets, but you're also lining theirs to a much greater degree. And that's just propagating people that then can abuse other people that you can't even help or see or are aware of. It's hard to rail against an industry that's kind of just stacked against so deeply, like, yeah, in society, like, so stacked against certain types of people, or just so built into the structure that this is the role that some people can play and this is the role that other people can play. And I mean, the stuff I've heard over my career, it's just,
oh yeah,
it's stuff that would be offensive in the 1920s and the 1800s, yeah, and like it still falls out of the mouths of like restaurant owners in the modern day. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, is the only way to fix the system by just not participating in it? But that takes a lot more, that's a bigger risk, and that's a lot scarier, and it takes a lot of capital too.
True.
Or just a lot of courage.
Yeah. I'm wondering how things are going to shift. I mean, I left the industry. I was still making money when I left the industry. I just decided I just didn't want to be there anymore. And I know that is, for a lot of people, that's kind of the intoxicating thing about it, is like, I can make a lot of money this way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I make a lot of money. And like, maybe it's worth it. Maybe putting up with this treatment is worth it because I can get myself in a better position by being able to like have this financial independence. But when you remove that, which right now, like even places that are open are not going to be making as much money as they would normally. I wonder if there's going to be a dynamic shift where like people decide this isn't worth it anymore.
I hope so. Honestly, I think that we're seeing so many people going back to work in conditions that just, if there's ever been a point where, and there have been so many jobs where I felt like nobody's looking out for me here. Like, mm-hmm, I'm on my own. I can show up and make my money, but anything bad happens to me, be it assault, be it verbal, physical, whatever, I'm on my own because these owners do not care. And now, I mean, we legitimately have a deadly virus in our city, but mm-hmm, in our world. Like, how do you go, with the money removed, exactly you say, like, how do you go back to work for people that they never took care of your safety when there wasn't a deadly threat?
Yeah.
Like at high risk. Like, how do you expect these people to take care of you now when the stakes are so much higher?
I mean, and yeah, you're right. And it's also like, I'm like, there's a lot of people who are in those positions in restaurant work who like literally don't have a choice. They don't have another thing that they can do. This is the only way that they can support themselves now. And their choice is to, you know, not make money or put themselves at risk. And that's like, that's really fucked up, guys. I mean, I don't know how you thought that we thought about this issue, but just to be clear, we think it's fucked up.
And I mean, there have been definitely jobs that I've stayed in because I couldn't afford not to. I was living paycheck to paycheck. There was no week where I could find another job. It was, I was already in debt as it was. Like, so I just put up with stuff. But like, it's a bigger thing when the thing you're just putting up with to survive is gambling your own life. And that's, nobody should be made to make that choice. Nobody should have to go to work and feel like they're choosing between paying their rent, but also rolling the dice on if like survive.
Man,
it's fucked up.
It is. So, you know, if you're in a position to tip a lot, then please get order takeout and tip a lot.
Yeah.
that's really what everybody's asking. Look out for your neighbors, man. Take care of your community.
Fight the police.
I mean, that's like, there's so many great like restaurant bars, and I mean, I'm sure across the nation, but definitely here in New York, that are doing takeout, but they're doing takeout cocktails. And I mean, mm-hmm. I don't go out much, even when the world's not suffering from a pandemic. And I've had so many amazing cocktails from bars that I probably never would have gone to because I've just ordered delivery from them. And like, I can enjoy this in my own home. What? Why do you want to like stand like elbow to elbow with people fighting for a seat at the bar when you can be on your couch watching Netflix and like drinking a cocktail that you would still, you pay much more for at a bar?
Yeah.
Like, that's the other thing. It's like the prices are great. So I don't know. I think that this is a really, you're still getting everything you get at a restaurant. If anything, you're getting a more comfortable experience. So the tip should be just exactly the same, if not more.
Yeah, if not more, for sure. From now on, if it wasn't before, from now on, always the message is if you can take care of the people around you, take care of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And they'll take care of you in return.
Yeah.
That's
everybody take care of each
everybody
other.
Everybody take care of everybody. And especially people in your bars and restaurants, because they don't have a lot of, you know, these are people that don't have insurance. Anybody that's having to go back to work, I totally understand. Like, I don't blame the people going back to work.
Absolutely.
I do raise an eyebrow to the owners that are not giving their employees 100% ability to define how they feel comfortable coming back to work.
Yes, that's a problem.
But yeah, I mean, you know, trailblazers, but those trails get covered up real fast, so...
Yeah, you gotta keep blazing pushing. The trail. Yeah.
Keep pushing, keep trying. I know, like, I think I'm not alone in feeling sometimes like maybe this just isn't for me, but it just delays somebody else having to fight harder later. I will share this one last anecdote, and it was one of the things that made me really think about how I center myself, how much my focus on my own survival can hurt other people. And that's that when I was working under a different bar manager, and he was awful. He was sexual predator, well-known fact. On my first shift with him, I was so proud to finally get bar shifts because I started out as a bar back. And he told me to stand up front and look pretty and he'd make the drinks. And it just, you know, here I was so excited to finally get bar shifts. And it just made me feel terrible and gross. Yeah. I mean, so on that same staff, you know, I dealt with it. I didn't say anything. I did not complain. I kept working there. At some point, one of the female servers came to me and asked if I would be willing to train her on the bar. She wanted to learn how to bartend. She was willing to do it on her own time. I came in and did it on my own time, like trained her so she knew everything I knew, so that when we had an opening on the bar, she could get a job there. She was an amazing dancer and she just wanted more time to focus on her dance, and she knew she could make more money behind the bar, work less shifts. It worked for her, you know, and then the bosses couldn't really complain. When we had an opening, she knew everything that I did. So she got shifts. And then she came to me very upset after one of her first shifts, and she'd worked with the same bar manager, and he said the exact same thing to her on one of her first shifts. Stand up front and look pretty and I'll make the drinks. And it just very demoralized her. She's like, you know, I came in on my own time. I trained for free. And like, this is how I get treated. It just like, I don't want to do this if I have to go in and be treated like that. And it was one of those moments where I was like, I didn't do enough. Like, I passed on knowledge, but I also set her up, enter into the same predatory relationship that I had just kind of been like, I can deal with it. But then the thought of somebody that I care about just dealing with it, like, it's different. So,
but
I don't
know. Didn't deserve that treatment from the beginning either.
No, but I didn't do enough. And maybe, I mean, you know, you have to push back. You have to push back against those people. And even if it's uncomfortable, I'm somebody that was born into and continue to have a lot of privilege in my life. So... Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes the path of least resistance is not the trail that needs blazing.
Yes. That's the quotable line, man.
Hey, there we go.
The path of least resistance is not the trail that needs blazing. Fuck Woo! Yes. Well, we'll leave you with that because damn.
Yeah. So as we all go back to work or contemplating going back to work, I think it's good if we all reassess our complacency, what we're doing, where we're devoting our energy. And these are both amazing women that we've talked about, but damn, Jewel.
Yeah, Jewel was pretty fucking awesome.
No insult to Ada. She was a lady of her time.
Yeah, but they are both awesome. Yeah. Jewel is like fighting the cops and... Yeah.
Gay.
And gay as fuck. Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah. All right. But Fuck yeah. Well, Trailblazers.
Yeah. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you, Taylor. Yeah.
Over on the video, obviously we're going to make you a hanky-panky and we'll come up with something to honor
Jules Catchone.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
Get creative with that. So if you're listening to this, join us there. If not, the video will remain on our YouTube in perpetuity. So yeah, kick over there, join us.
Thank you to Absurdus for our theme music. Thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who helped us donate to the Ochre Project this past month. You can still donate directly to the Ochre Project by visiting www.theochreproject.com, and we hope that you do.
I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been
Neat.
Thank you for sharing your story.